bonjour, hi, Canada. It's the last radio hour of the week, the hour that we set aside for the biggest issues out there, the ones that endure, the one that travel and course through history with the Hillsdale Dialogue. All things Hillsdale are found at hillsdale.edu. All these conversations stretching back 8 years are found at hugh4hillsdale.com. I'm joined this morning, as I am most Fridays, by Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. Good morning, Dr. Arnn. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I am terrific. I want to, we have been following generally the course of the Hillsdale American Heritage Reader, and we're going to do that today with Federalist 39, 51, and the Letters of Fabius. But if I can look ahead 2 weeks to when we get to George Washington and his farewell address, he warned against entangling alliances. Does that still obtain, especially when we find one of our closest and strongest allies, the Free State of Israel, a republic itself, which we'll be talking about what is a republic today, does that still obtain George Washington's warning?
Well, sure, in the way that he meant it, right? But it's a prudential thing. John Adams himself wrote a commentary on it at the time. And he said, yeah, that's given all the circumstances now, that's right. But the circumstances have changed now. And what? It's a smaller world, right? 85% of the world's population lives in Europe and Asia. Africa. Eurasia and Africa. I think it's about two-thirds that lives in Eurasia. And so if you just look at a map with that in mind, those Asia and Africa are close to each other. And we are equivalent of Great Britain now. We're an island off the coast of the great landmass, and, it comes at us from two sides. And the oceans are wide, but you can cross them now in minutes with a missile. And so, you're going to have to, if you look at the classic British foreign policy, it's very shrewd. And what it did was it tried to be a sort of make-weight on the continent. Britain's a little country compared to us, a little country, but compared to China, we're a little country. And so what they did was they basically made alliances against the strongest power. I mean, that means China today. And the stuff that's happening in Israel, I mean, it's because of our weakness, right? You didn't get this when Trump was president. And in fact, you got it before, too. And so what would you do about China? Well, first of all, Israel is the ideal ally because it's located in a strategic place and because it's a free country. And old ties with them. And they need us, and we need them. But then look at the island powers along the coast of China. Look at Taiwan and Japan and Korea. And God, we shouldn't let the Philippines get away, but they kind of have. And those things mean that you've got, allies to help you against something mighty. And, the Chinese and Iran, too, they have a virtue from our point of view. People fear and hate them. And that's because they're to be feared. I mean, look at Hong Kong, right? And so we are not to be feared in that same way. Increasingly, we're held in contempt, but we need to turn that around.
Let me ask you about that. I had Neil Ferguson on this week for an extended conversation about his new book, Doom, The Politics of Disaster, wherein are contained effective, I believe, refutations of any cycle of history theory. We're not doomed to fall apart as an empire, though he thinks we are under great stress. But I wonder if you agree with that. Are empires inevitably doomed, and is America an empire right now, Dr. Arnn?
No and no. Except the first one is partly yes. Every human thing, is not eternal, right? So and from that point of view, the United States of America is a human thing, and all human things pass away. But what timetable? And so if you study Churchill, you learn that it's not trends that are important, it's choices. And, if Churchill's argument of his life that went on his whole life is that he had been listened to, especially in the 1930s. Then the final disaster that struck British greatness, the Second World War, would not have happened. And it's a different world if that doesn't happen. And whether the First World War could have been prevented, it's certainly true that for months before, Churchill spent all his time trying to make a deal with Germany so there didn't need to be a war. Churchill was First Lord of the Admiralty, and the provoking thing that the Germans did was they started building an ocean-going navy, and they were already the dominant land power, and that was a mortal threat to Britain. And that's one reason why Britain aligned with France, and France aligned with, in the First World War, Russia. And so Churchill tried to unpack all of that, to cut that Gordian knot and find a way to make a lasting arrangement with Germany. And he went very far. He didn't care if the Germans got colonies in Africa and other places. They did have some. He welcomed them as a world power. But they didn't want that. They wanted to be the dominant power.
You know, this is far afield, Doctor, and I want to bring it back to Federalist 39 because it's specifically about empires and republics. But Neil Ferguson makes the argument in Doom that any very long studied student of World War One, as you are, that when you boil it down and get to the essence of why Britain went to war, the majority party went to war to keep the Tories out. Do you agree with that?
No.
You and he have to join me on this show to discuss that, because I found that rather different from your assessments of World War One.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, so I know a fair amount about Winston Churchill, and he was in that government. And the idea that he would go to war to win an election, he was from 1898 at the Battle of Omdurman in Sudan, very south Egypt, he watched a battle, and it changed his life. I mean, he saw something for the first time. The British, about 15,000 British, were charged by about 35,000 dervishes, as they were called. They were actually the first Islamic radical republic. And they just wiped them out with machine guns and artillery. The dervish soldier that got closest to the British line got about 150 yards near it, which means they could hardly see him. And Churchill was, everybody else thought that was the greatest victory in the world. Churchill was appalled by it because he said, look what we can do now. And what if two armies come together, right? And so that'd just be a terribly corrupt thing if...
We should talk about that because he is learned in World War One. I thought it was something of a throw-off line. I talked to him about it, but he stood by it. I do believe what we ought to take away from that lesson about how it scaled, what's going on in Israel right now, it's thousands of missiles. So whatever Churchill thought we could do to each other, we can do a lot more of it now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's, I don't follow military strategy enough to be an expert on it, but I read, and, you know, China seems to be developing a capacity to basically wipe us out from afar. They've got a missile that can attack an aircraft carrier from 1,200 miles away, and, it goes subspace and comes back down at vast speed. And we've apparently got some defenses against that, but an aircraft carrier, you know, and our strategic problem is we're an island, and we don't have that many people compared to Eurasia and Africa. And so we have to project power, and the aircraft carrier is the greatest invention ever for doing that, but they're very vulnerable now. That's one reason why I think that those... what they call unsinkable aircraft carriers, those island nations off the Chinese coast, are important. I also think India is very important.
Oh, my gosh. And they call it the Guam killer as well as the carrier killer. It's a Guam killer because if you do a storm of these things, you can destroy one of those unsinkable. You might not be able to sink it, but you can wreck it. I'll be right back. Dr. Arnn and I turn to Federalist 3951 and the Letters of Fabius. And if you're not familiar with the Letters of Fabius, say you live around Pittsburgh, you definitely want to stay tuned. We'll be right back. The Hillsdale Dialogue continues. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. All of these conversations collected at youforhillsdale.com.
If and when news happens anywhere, you'll hear it here first. First, when Hugh Hewitt continues.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Larry Arnn is my guest as the Hillsdale Dialogue proceeds. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. Dr. Arnn, when I was rereading Federalist 39, I was reminded of what Martin Luther said of the epistle of James, which is it's a, quote, right strawy epistle, meaning it didn't really fit with his understanding, but it was in Scripture. 39 is, to me, the always puzzling, why did they have to spend so much time on national government versus federal government when you're going to, the question of whether or not the new Constitution would propose the former or the latter, and then end up saying, well, we're really both and not either. Why was that such a crucial question during the ratification debates of 1878 and 9?
Well, you know, we're talking about 1789, and the first colonies are established in the first decade of the 17th century. That means close to 200 years earlier. And the state governments were long practiced and powerful. And Lincoln says in his first inaugural address that they never had a separate existence. That is to say, for all of that long history, they were united under the British crown, and then they declared independence together. But they had operated extensively by themselves. And they had interests, you know, governments, and they're like people, right? Some of them were great trading places, and that means commerce had to flow through them to get to little places. And so the little places had an interest. And you know, long-established and very successful custom, by the way, had worked. And the Federalists had a different vision of all of that. And I believe that the compromises that were worked out in the Constitutional Convention that allowed Madison to write in the 39th Federalist that it is partly national and partly federal, I believe those compromises are significantly responsible for the duration of the Constitution, because it was a marvelous system of balances, and the federal government adds a complication to it, right? Because we know state governments were not performing very well on their own. We know Shays' Rebellion went on for nearly a year, ended in February before the summer that they called the Constitutional Convention. Straddled that and the Annapolis Convention, which was in late 1786, that called on the Congress to call a bigger convention and think about reforms, because the American Union was failing. And if you read the Anti-Federalist Papers, we don't have one today, but if you read Brutus and Sentinel and all them, they all admit that significant reforms are necessary and that a stronger central government is necessary. But on the other hand, nobody wants, you know, Madison and Hamilton, they went to the Constitutional Convention with a draft that said the federal government should be allowed to legislate in all cases whatsoever, which copies a phrase from the Declaratory Act that was one of the steps to the American Revolution. But they didn't imagine, on the other hand, that a Congress in Philadelphia or Washington, eventually Washington, D.C., would legislate details about what would happen in a city or a town.
But you know what confuses me about this, Larry Arnn, is that in the great scholarship of the era, you have contributed to that. I believe Lynn Cheney's work on Madison's remarkable, or Virginia Dynasty, they're really living this debate. This debate's a real present danger to them. They need to get the Constitution changed. I just don't know how 39 added to their way. 51 is glorious. 78 is important. 10 is wonderful. But we have a minute to the break. 39, did that really turn anyone's minds?
Sure, because it satisfied the argument. It addressed directly the central argument of the Anti-Federalists, which was we're simply nationalizing the government. And 39 is, no, we're not, only partly. Which, by the way, is an honest argument.
It's the two angels and a devil on your shoulder thing. He argues among himself in a rather brief period. It's wonderful reading, but it is a shadow of Federalist 51 to which we return. Maybe the greatest essay in American political history. Dr. Arnn can think about that during the break, and we'll come back to the Hillsdale Dialogue on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
You're in the middle of a nonstop, action-packed information blitz. The Hugh Hewitt Show is coming right back.
Welcome back, America. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway. This week, we just talked about Federalist 39. We're about to talk about Federalist 51 and the letter of Fabius. Dr. Arnn, I've told you before on the Hugh Hewitt Show as we do the Hillsdale Dialogue, when I was young, I took early American political writing from the wonderful Judith Schlar, who was not a conservative, but she was quite a good scholar. And I believe I got it from there that Federalist 51 is the greatest essay in American history. Now, there are competitors, right? There are lots, 10, and there's Thomas Paine. You could argue the Gettysburg Address is an essay, but it's a speech. What do you make of 51 in our pantheon of arguments?
Well, it's certainly one of the most important, and in one important respect, it's the key to unlock the purposes of the Constitution. It takes more than Federalist 10 and more than Federalist 51 to unlock those purposes. But what 51, its argument is very beautiful, and it is that how do you get good government? Right, that's the question in Plato's Republic. It's very hard to get, right? And so one plan is the Anti-Federalist plan, which is localize it so the government's close to the people and will not afflict them. And that was shown not to be working, and it is shown in history not to work. Little countries become despotic too. And then another plan is education. Rely on the virtue of people. John Dickinson is given to that argument, a great man, by the way, who didn't support the Declaration of Independence. So that's insufficient, right? And so what you're going to end up with is a mixture, and that means the American system is not difficult to describe. There's a beautiful statement of the final cause of the country, written in lovely words that everybody can remember. Right, in the Declaration of Independence. But then they found a form, a way for the government to operate that would stop the worst in us, that would inconvenience the worst in us and convenience the best in us. And all of the Federalist, the whole describes, it's the greatest work of American political theory. And what it describes is a system that achieves that if you want to be effective in America, you've got to talk out loud because you got to reach a lot of people across vast spaces. And if you want to be effective, you have to have broad support, which because of federalism and the Electoral College has to be localized across the country, though. And that means a big movement is what will work. And then you have to control three separate bodies, popular bodies. You have to control the presidency and the Senate and the House, and they are elected at different times and in different ways. And so when Madison says in 51 that the most important thing about the Constitution, its contribution to preserving American freedom, is its structure. It's the way it's conformed. And what does he mean? He means those things. He means see, it starts with representation. It's a representative government, and that means, first of all, we don't do it ourselves, but we hold the power. Once you have that, then the people can delegate their authority to different bodies in different ways. If the people were the legislative branch, then they just have to all meet, impractical in America, and decide. That's why Athens was so changeable, right? And if the executive was a king and the sovereign, then he could just act, right? But because of representation, because we're sovereign, but we delegate to the government, we can give some of the power to the president and some to the Senate and some to the House and some to the courts. And that means that they have to work together to get anything done. And the Federalist, by the way, is very concerned that things get done. They understand. That's why the unitary executive, the president, can act. Once there's a law, the president can act. And he doesn't have to call Congress. He can act. But if he acts wrongly too much, well, the Congress controls the purse strings and appointments to his branch of government, right? And so the point is, it's set up so that, one of the most famous lines in 51 is, ambition must counteract ambition. Public-spiritedness is vital, and virtue in the people is vital. But when it gets down to it, sort of on an ordinary operating basis, then the Congress it's given away a lot of it, by the way, but it's given the power to fight the president, partly by being given a share of the executive power. And the president is given the power to fight the Congress. And that power is, he can veto laws, he can act, expeditiously. And so, in other words, they go into combat, none of them is disarmed. And they will want to protect their interests. Ambition is what it is, right? Why do you get elected Congress? Because you want to legislate, you want to do something important. Now, you have to remember, in light of this, because the scheme is brilliant and the most successful in human history, that the staggering thing that has happened that is the cause of so many of our woes today is that the Congress delegated the legislative power to an executive bureaucracy. And that means a lot more laws can be made, and that means that this executive bureaucracy constitutes an interest of itself. Now, something new was that,
and in fact, the growth of that is so dangerous, especially when one faction controls the House, the Senate, and the executive. And I refer back to Neil Ferguson. He said our government is not getting better as it gets bigger, but it's getting bigger with every year. And one faction right now controls those two. Thank goodness they don't control the courts to the extent that Donald Trump checked them. Because our rights would be at most danger if all of the agencies of government, federal and state, and all of the divisions of government within the federal and the state are all controlled by the same faction.
That's right. And just remember that the reinforcement of one of the factions comes from what you can call the administrative state. Because, the way the Fortune 500 companies are associated with the government, the way they have powwows and act together in politics, the fact that the public employee unions are, an enormous factor, I think the largest single factor in funding electoral politics in America, that means that they're parties to the controversy in a big scale and with specific interest to defend. One of them is their power to run the thing, to run the world. And so we have created, and it took a long time, right? Because this started in the The movement for this started in the 1880s, and it came from Germany, right? This idea that we will build a state with stakeholders and administrative interest populating the state, which will bring stability and unity.
And expertise, allegedly expertise.
Yeah, well, and that's right, the power of science, too. And that was particularly powerful in America because, you know, we are very successful people and we think we can do anything and we get to thinking science can do anything. But, you know, look at this pandemic, right? It's just in a nation run by experts, what coherence is there in all of this? I mean, the rules are contradictory. They're heavily disputed among the experts. And yet, on the other hand, the disputes that don't favor Anthony Fauci running the world, those are suppressed. And so it's a force, right? The American people are facing a vast force. And one of the implications of Federalist 51 is you're supposed to break all that up, right?
You know, I am confident that as we speak, at least one justice and maybe more of the Supreme Court are listening to us. So I would ask you to keep that in mind when you answer this. Comfortably Smug and Josh Holmes, who do the Ruthless podcast, now, as a joke, routinely refer to Chief Justice Thomas of the Supreme Court. We know it's Chief Justice Roberts, but their joke is Justice Thomas now has 5 votes. And therefore, you can expect a more vigorous Supreme Court. And indeed, all the government is not aligned. I'm wondering if you expect the new majority on the Supreme Court to act with more ruthlessness against the administrative state via the non-delegation doctrine, via the narrowing of Chevron or its outright repeal. Do you expect them to act in response to the growth of this administrative state, which I think at least 6 of them fear, at least as much as you and I do?
Well, first of all, remember, they're under threat, right? I mean,
Yes, explicit.
I guess we're going to read it. Hamilton says in the 78th Federalist that it's the judges of the least dangerous branch.
I was transitioning.
And I think that's still true today. And why? Because, you know, Lincoln says, this is, by the way, a summary of Aristotle's Politics in a sentence. Every nation has a central idea from which all its minor thoughts radiate. So this corruption that's happened in America is powerful in part because it proceeds in the name of the people. And so the judicial branch is the one that has the least contact with the people. They thought, and they were right to think for most of American history, that the greatest danger to American liberties would come from the United States House of Representatives, the closest to the people. It's just that due to an ideology that seeped into the country, darned if the House of Representatives and the Senate didn't give away substantial parts of their power.
And that's what, when we come back, we got to talk about 78, because it is not the least dangerous branch. It just depends who's judging. And we got a minute, Dr. Arnn. When Earl Warren and his majority were there, they judged poorly. Now we have Chief Justice Roberts and his majority, and I think they judge wisely. And so I'm an optimist, and I'm very thankful to Donald Trump for having done this, lest we would be thrown upon the administrative state completely right now.
Well, I agree with that, by the way. Any port in a storm, right?
Yeah.
If you ask me, do I think they will? I fear not, but I pray they will, and I pray they can pull it off, and I pray the filibuster holds so they don't just overrun it, right?
They could overrun it. We'll come back and they could overrun it. That is a danger. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. That's in Federalist 51. If legislators were angels, they wouldn't try and strip the Supreme Court of its authority. But we don't know. We do not know. I'll be right back with Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale to talk about Fabius and Hamilton and that worry.
This is the Hugh Hewitt Show.
And error destruction. That's the third letter of Fabius, also writing in support of the Constitution. Dr. Arne, you know, he's a kind of a revelation to me, Dickinson. I know about him as a historical figure, but I haven't read his stuff before. In fact, I always kind of thought that Abraham Lincoln cooked up apples of gold and frames of silver, and here I find him using that and attributing it to the Greeks. And you had had me persuaded it was a Lincolnian phraseology, but he used it at first. What is Fabius's role here except to tell us, don't ever trust people who have high hopes for people generally?
Well, first of all, he helped get the Constitution through the state of Pennsylvania. And he was an odd guy. He was a great man, by the way. He was simultaneously a member of the legislature of Pennsylvania and the president of Delaware. Government used to work in odd ways, still does, different odd ways. And so he was a powerful figure. He wrote beautifully. And he both helped to stimulate and then at a key moment restrain the American Revolution. He wouldn't vote for the Declaration of Independence. It cost him because it was an unpopular thing that he did. He still rose up from it and became important in the Constitutional Convention. And he's also understood as a man who's a balanced man, right? He's yes and no all the time. You heard me say that earlier in this show.
Yes.
And so he's trusted, and his arguments are good. They're indirect. I don't think that they're as serious as the Federalist, but they're serious, and he was important. And, you know, why did he not sign a vote? He absented himself. He didn't sign, and he didn't vote the Declaration of Independence. Well, he thought we should go get an ally first. And, you know, that's, you know, sending somebody across the water to go talk to the French court or whoever you're going to talk to. And that could take a long time, right? And they'd been trying that. People were he misjudged, in my opinion, the timing of things. And so, you know, at some point, you know, the American Revolution was a very bold thing and very doubtful of success. But the people who benefited from it and became the most famous people in American history are the people who picked the time rightly and threw the dice.
And were bold. And Franklin became one of those. Now, I want to go to Dickinson's. He's very optimistic about the country. And I want you to comment on the line I thought most important. What an infatuated, depraved people must Americans become if, with such unequal advantages committed to their trust in a manner almost miraculous, they lose their liberty. I don't know that he had a long enough time frame there, Dr. Arndt.
Yeah, well, just think. I mean, like right now, by the way, the world is shifting every day in fearsome ways. And that's what this time was like, you know? I mean, they burned John Dickinson's farm. And many people's farms, and his house on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, that famous old street near the Independence Hall. And so these calculations that people make in the pressure of events, they're very easy to look back now and say who was right. That's why I added the caveat, in my opinion, because, you know, they're all at risk, and everything they know and love is at risk. And isn't there some easier way out of this than to make war on the biggest place in the world? And then the same thing, right? When you get to the Constitutional Convention and the debates over the Constitution, Dickinson went, in my opinion, the right way about that. But the fears that we were building a dominating power in a central place to replace the one we got rid of, those were real. And it's easy to think today, by the way, that the anti-federalist who warned that we're building a new set of masters, it's easy to think that they were correct about that, because we have a new set of masters now.
Well, you shot me down when I said that last week.
Well, I'm going to add my caveat, right? You're expecting too much of human affairs if you think that the most successful constitution and the longest lasting constitution in history was a mistake because lately it has gone wrong. Because they all go wrong. right? There's no long history of a written constitution in a mighty nation lasting a long time. And ours has survived by the skin of its teeth many times, and I hope and believe that it's going to do that again today, but by the skin of its teeth.
And next week, we're going to talk about next week, a revolution that did not go right. The French Revolution didn't take long for it to break down either, Dr. Arne.
No, and that was, you know, there was, first of all, you can't, the differences are very great between the American and the French Revolution. And one of the greatest differences.
Don't give it away. Next week. The Rights of Man, Thomas Paine and the French Revolution. A little Edmund Burke thrown in as well when Dr. Arne returns. In the meantime, go to hillsdale.edu. If you want all of this heavy doses, hillsdale.edu. We'll talk to you next week on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Absolutely, positively need the truth. This is where you turn. This is the Hugh Hewitt Show.